From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR sports program Only a Game. Colin Kaepernick is the most hated player in the NFL, except he's not in the NFL. He's a free agent. So why would Sports Illustrated send a reporter to a game wearing a Kaepernick jersey?
This is a very, very hot button issue. It's race, politics, mix of all these things that are going on in this country right now, symbolized with one person in one jersey.
That's coming up on Only a Game. Plus, in 1934, the Detroit Free Press wished a Happy New Year to Hank Greenberg and just maybe changed some Detroiters' minds about Judaism. Stay tuned. Pretend the year is 1934, and you, being the baseball fan that you are, want to know how your team did yesterday. You can't just look it up with a smartphone in your pocket because there's no smartphone in your pocket. Instead, you turn to the sports page of your local newspaper. But in September of 1934, the Detroit Free Press did a lot more than report the scores. The paper took a stand. Reporter Noam Hassenfeld has our story.
Let's take a look at the standings. It's September 10th, 1934. With 20 games left in the season, the Detroit Tigers are 4 games up on the second-place New York Yankees. It sounds like a cushy lead, but remember, these are the Babe Ruth Yankees. Against these guys, a 4-game lead with 20 to play is anything but safe.
Tigers could win the pennant.
Documentary filmmaker and baseball superfan Aviva Kempner.
And they had not come in first since 1909.
The Tigers are riding the hot hitting of 23-year-old phenom Hank Greenberg. Playing in only his second full season in the bigs, Hank is batting .338, leading the league in doubles.
And I was probably the only batter in the lineup that was not in a slump.
That's audio from Aviva's documentary, The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg. Now, just hours before a crucial game against the Boston Red Sox, Hank sits alone in the clubhouse. He's perfectly healthy and enjoying the best season of his young career, but still something nags at him. Today is Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year.
He's a nice Jewish boy from New York, grew up Orthodox. And what is he going to do living in Detroit during this pennant race?
Jewish holidays aren't just family gatherings or celebrations. Instead, they come with a long list of ritual prohibitions. Traditionally, these include driving, writing, using electricity, but most importantly, working. And as much as baseball is a game, for Hank, it's his job. It's not an easy decision for Hank. He isn't personally very religious, but still, his tradition is important to him. But more than being about his own religious identity, this decision has even deeper implications. In 1930s America, being Jewish was very different than it is today. Neighborhoods barred Jews from buying homes, stores had signs which read, "No Jews or dogs allowed," and the 1924 Immigration Act had installed quotas which significantly slowed Jewish immigration to the U.S., and right in Hank's backyard,
Detroit was really the hotbed of domestic anti-Semitism.
Car magnate Henry Ford, perhaps the most famous Detroiter of that era, spent much of his spare time distributing anti-Semitic propaganda. His newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, went so far as to call Jews, quote, the world's foremost problem.
But more importantly, there was Father Charles Coughlin,
a Catholic priest in Detroit who used his radio program to spread anti-Semitic messages to an estimated 30 million weekly listeners.
We are Christian insofar as we believe in Christ's principle of love your neighbor as yourself. And with that principle, I challenge every Jew in this nation to tell me that he does not believe in it.
And Hank experienced this anti-Semitism up close. Here's his son, Steve.
They were calling him every name in the book. Sheeny, kike, throw him a pork chop, he can't hit that.
Hank was worried that choosing to sit on Rosh Hashanah might inspire even more vitriol. But a curious thing happened. The city's major paper, the Detroit Free Press, rallied behind him. The day before Rosh Hashanah, at the top of the sports section was a headline written from right to left in strange, large letters. It read, L'shana tova tikatevu.
In Hebrew letters, front page, it was as if war had been declared. The type was that big.
An English headline right next to the Hebrew read, "And so to you, Mr. Greenberg, Tigers fans say L'shana tova tikatevu," which means Happy New Year. According to Jonathan Sarna, professor of American Jewish history at Brandeis University, this may be the only instance of a major American newspaper with a Hebrew headline. And think about what it took to make this a reality. This was before digital printing, so the Free Press would have had to get special metal plates just to print these three words.
I have no idea to this day where they got the metal type for this Hebrew.
And immediately below the Hebrew headline, there was a huge picture of Hank mid-swing. It was almost as if the paper was saying, "Please, Hank, we need you." Okay, back to where we started. It's late afternoon on Rosh Hashanah, and Hank is sitting in the Tigers clubhouse in his street clothes. He actually came here straight from synagogue. He looks up and spots Coach Mickey Cochran, who tells him this, "I need you out there, but in the end, it's your choice." Hank decides to play. As the game gets underway, congregants at the synagogue are on the edge of their seats. Here's Tigers fan Harold Allen.
While the canter was singing, he was stopped for a minute and says, "How's Hank doing?" The whole interest of the city of Detroit was Hank Greenberg.
The Tigers are in a nail-biter against the Boston Red Sox. They trail 1-0 for most of the game, but Hank is the lone bright spot for Detroit, tying things up with a solo homer in the seventh. Now, in a 1-1 game, he calmly strolls out of the dugout to lead off the bottom of the ninth. Hank digs in while Red Sox pitcher Gordon Rhodes peers in for the sign. The crowd grows into a steady roar as Rhodes winds up and fires. Hank's bat whips through the zone and the ball rockets up and out of the park. A walk-off home run from the Hebrew Hammer as the Tigers win 2-1. The next day, a picture of Hank, mid-home run trot, graces the sports section once again. This time, the headline reads, "A Happy New Year for Everybody." So, happy ending for Hank and the Tigers, right? Well, the thing is, there are a whole bunch of Jewish holidays in the fall, so Hank's story isn't done yet. Up next, the most important one of all, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Over the next week, Detroit fans waited on pins and needles to see if Hank would play. And believe it or not, the best place for fans to find out if Jewish law might allow him to was, of all places, the sports page of the Detroit Free Press.
And all the newspapers in the city were debating, would the power hitter play or not?
Jewish ritual practices weren't exactly the kinds of things most people knew about. But before Detroiters knew what hit them, technicalities of Jewish law were being expounded in the sports page. The most important question to answer: was it kosher that Hank had played on Rosh Hashanah? As Hank's son Steve says, one rabbi
decreed that Hank Greenberg could play on Rosh Hashanah because he found an obscure text in the Talmud that said that on Rosh Hashanah, the children played in the streets of Jerusalem.
And looking back on Hank's two Rosh Hashanah home runs, the famed writer Iffy the Dopester, not Jewish as far as I know, issued his verdict in the pages of the Free Press, writing this: "I do not know anything about the law of the most ancient church in the world. That's all for students of the Talmud. But I'm here to testify in the world as a baseball expert that the two hits he made in that ballgame were strictly kosher." Let's not take for granted the basic fact that a major American newspaper in the 1930s was debating intricacies of Jewish law. In a place famous for its anti-Semitism, it showed just how much Hank was respected throughout Detroit. But at the same time, some were less than thrilled with Hank's decision. That rabbi who said Jews were playing in the streets on Rosh Hashanah? Well, according to Jewish historian Irwin Cohen, it's more complicated than that.
He came out very upset after that, that he was misquoted.
Cohen says that Rabbi Thuman did say Jews had played ball, but he meant children, so it wouldn't apply to adults. And he says that according to Jewish law, it would be very difficult to permit playing in a professional baseball game on Rosh Hashanah.
Very Orthodox man, long white beard, dressed in black. He's from a long line of Orthodox families. Rabbi Thuman did not give Hank Greenberg permission to play in Rosh Hashanah.
Hank received phone calls and telegrams from rabbis and Orthodox Jews who felt that he had given up on his religion. People who claimed he'd make it harder for Jews to stay true to their faith in the future. To this part of the Jewish community, Hank represented a very real fear: the loss of traditional Jewish life. Hank seemed like someone who, when push came to shove, would choose his livelihood over his religion. 8 days after Rosh Hashanah, with the Tigers leading the Yankees by 7.5 games on Yom Kippur, Tigers fans were anxiously awaiting Hank's decision. He'd played on the Jewish New Year, but would he play on the most solemn day in the Jewish calendar? For Hank, religion was complicated. The week before, when he'd been asked to lead a prayer, he said, "I'm only a ball player. Give it to someone else who really deserves it." But still, when it came to Yom Kippur,
Hank Greenberg decided to honor his Romanian-born parents by trekking to the synagogue instead of suiting up during this raging pennant race.
The only way I would ever think that I might have been a hero in those days was the day I walked into the Sherazadeh Temple on Yom Kippur. The four rabbis standing on the podium, davening, praying, and suddenly I walk in, and everybody in the congregation gets up and gives me, and the poor rabbi looks around, he doesn't know what's happening, and I'm as embarrassed as can be, because it's all totally unexpected.
Greenberg was out yesterday observing Yom Kippur, and I believe, undoubtedly, Hank's big bat was missed out here yesterday.
With Hank sitting out, the Tigers lost. But once again, the Detroit Free Press didn't waver. They published a poem from Edgar Guest. Here's Hank's son, Steve.
And it said, "We shall miss him in the infield, we shall miss him at the bat, but he's true to his religion, and we honor him for that."
Think about that newspaper, with those three Hebrew words, Lishana Tova Tikatevu, emblazoned on the sports page. Then take a second to think about when and where this was happening, a time when Jews were viewed as a threat to America. And for some, they still are.
Jews will not replace us! Jews will not replace us!
Let's be real clear. Hank Greenberg did not play on Yom Kippur in 34 as Hitler was rising in Europe. And that's what made it even more powerful. And after what happened in Charlottesville, I hope some more Jewish baseball players don't play on Yom Kippur.
Since Hank did it, great Jewish players like Sandy Koufax and Sean Green have also chosen to sit out on Yom Kippur. But this ability to take a stand depends on the press. In 1934, the Detroit Free Press truly had the power to frame Hank's decision, and it didn't choose to present Hank as some sort of radical outsider with a strange and inscrutable religion. Instead, the Free Press portrayed Hank's decision with the complexity it deserved, describing the real conflict of identity that Hank, and to be honest, many Jews felt at the time.
I think the newspapers, just like today, played a very important role in saying anti-Semitism, racism do not belong on the ball field, do not belong in society. And the fact of the matter is, the way the Free Press covered, will Hank play on Rosh Hashanah, was again the power of the press saying it's okay for a player to make a stand.
That's filmmaker Aviva Kempner speaking with reporter Noam Hassenfeld, and her documentary is called The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. Poker Face Chet recently left the following review of Only a Game on iTunes. If you get the idea that sports are, in fact, a little less important than the human beings who participate in and watch them, you'll love this show. The crew regularly brings us stories of inspiration, humor, and poignancy. They can even make stories about soccer sound interesting. Thanks, I think, Poker Face Chet, but lay off the soccer jokes, okay? And please, if you have a moment, consider going to iTunes and leaving a review. It really does help other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield.
From 44 yards. The way. And he missed it.
The Chargers debuted at their new home in Los Angeles last Sunday, and it wasn't great. And that's where we're going to begin on this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know. My guests are the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay and Sports on Earth's Will Leach. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Bill.
An honor as always, sir.
Will, the honor will continue. Tell us about that Chargers game.
Yes, I was at that game. They played it at the StubHub Center, the home of the Los Angeles Galaxy soccer team, which holds 27,000 people. It was not full. I believe Greg Gumbel was, in fact, not using a microphone. And any sound that you heard at the end of that kick that was missed that cost the Chargers the game probably was the loudest cheer of anything that happened the whole game, because there were probably more Miami Dolphins fans there. Obviously, with the NFL's mistakes and all the troubles they've had, they had 20 years to figure out the Los Angeles thing and then just kind of like threw two teams out the car window. They didn't stop on the road as they were kind of passing by. And so one of the things that's kind of funny is I was expecting indifference from Los Angeles fans about the Chargers, because that's mostly what I got when I talked to them about the Rams. I went to the game last year. This year was more outright hostility. It was that San Diego's team. We want nothing to do with them. It was really quite amazing to see the Chargers, a popular team in San Diego and not even that bad of a team, playing in this intimate environment. It was about the saddest possible way to introduce your team to a new city.
I think it's probably a bad omen for the Chargers to put their games in a stadium which gave its naming rights to a secondary ticket marketing company. There are some merits, I suppose, to watching bad football from much farther away. We should take this into consideration when we consider intimacy in sporting events, that you might not want to be terribly close to a Chargers game.
Will, I understand that you do have some suggestions regarding the Chargers, how they might be able to reverse this situation. Let us know what some of them are.
One way would be to embrace kind of the strange situation. I remember when I lived in Los Angeles 20 years ago, and there was an advertisement in the Los Angeles Times that had a really big picture of Michael Jordan and a really small picture of Brett Barry. The tagline said, "Brett Barry and the Clippers don't have to pay a lot to watch Michael Jordan this year, and now you don't either. Get our six-game package." So it's a temporary home, treated as a temporary home, almost like the Airbnb of sports.
What about bespoke home delivery? What about just having the Chargers come play at your house?
We got a big backyard. Why not?
Yeah, it doesn't even have to be that big of a backyard, frankly, with the
medium.
Number of people.
All right, so the Chargers are sad. Let's move on to a happy topic, at least for lots of baseball fans. Home runs are happy. And this season, the total home run record has fallen. That's the number of home runs across all of Major League Baseball. The Maguire-Sosa era totals are piddling compared to what the sluggers and even people who were never sluggers before have accomplished this season. Some of the pitchers are saying the ball is juiced. Major League Baseball says the ball is not juiced, and neither are the hitters. And the fans just seem to be enjoying the dingers. Should we be suspicious this time around that either Major League Baseball has juiced the ball to make the game more popular, or that the players, like athletes throughout time, have found new undetectable substances with which to become better sluggers? Jason, what do you think?
Well, I mean, gentlemen, has there been anything in baseball history that would lead you to believe that there was perhaps some sort of illicit substances being used? You know, I think suspicion is pretty acceptable here. Baseball likes to talk very much about the fact that it has cleaned up its act, that its drug testing has become more stringent, and that its drug testing might be the class of major sports in America. But that is a very, very, very low bar. Anytime you hear explanations ranging from launch angles of bats to the kinds of balls that are being used to the acceleration now of high-speed pitching, you know, you got to throw in the normal, traditional Occam's razor type explanations, which have borne out historically anytime you've seen unprecedented performance in any kind of athletic endeavor. Mm. So if that makes me a bitter old baseball skeptic, I'll accept that.
One thing I will say, I like that we've got to the point, by the way, that we are now using the word tradition in the same sentence as performance-enhancing drugs. Like in the green tradition of baseball, there are performance-enhancing drugs.
People talk about greenies like it was some great tradition like Cracker Jack. They had a jar of greenies, Will! They'd go in there and they'd have their chewing tobacco and they'd have their greenies!
I don't quite have the moral outrage about performance-enhancing drugs that I think a lot of people do. But I would also say that I think poo-pooing the idea of launch angles and poo-pooing the idea of – like there have been scientific studies to talk about how the ball does seem to be wound tighter this year. And listen, you look at the way the direction the game is going. This is becoming a three true outcome sport: home runs, walks, strikeouts, mm-hmm. particularly strikeouts. So many strikeouts. Certainly, there's probably people in baseball that are taking drugs that we don't know about. But I do not think that this is a sudden spike because of that specific thing.
Why is baseball so adamant about saying that it's not the ball? Every time these kinds of rushes have happened, they've been very quick to say that nothing is amiss with the ball.
Yeah, I see your point. As long as everybody's hitting the same ball, what the hell's the difference?
Yeah, but then you wouldn't be able to blame the players for it. And listen, I don't think that there is a secret memo out there from Rob Manfred saying, tight the balls a little tighter, tighter with the balls. That's not how Rob Manfred talks at all, by the way.
No, that's more like how Count Dracula talks.
Yes, yes. I was going for a Montgomery Burns a little there, too. But there is no memo of him, like, demanding that to happen. But this is not the first time that a ball in history would be a little tighter or a little looser. But the problem is, in this kind of environment, particularly with the tradition of baseball, as we've talked about, people are going to see nefariousness in every corner. Or justified or not.
If somebody wants to investigate the abundance of home runs, it's fine with me as long as it's not the U.S. Congress, because as far as I'm concerned, there are more important things for them to do than talk to people like Mark McGwire and Curt Schilling. Jason, last but not least, you got to hang out with Emma Stone. Explain, please.
Well, that's just a Thursday for me, Bill, in my life. But I did get to speak to the lovely Emma Stone, the Oscar winner from La La Land, whose new movie is out. It's Battle of the Sexes, in which Emma Stone plays Billie Jean King in her famous 1973 triumph over Bobby Riggs. And what I wanted to talk about here was that, guys, there have been a lot of bad tennis movies. Wimbledon didn't really live up to Wimbledon. However, I have to say that Battle of the Sexes not only succeeds in rendering the great life of Billie Jean King, but also is a really great tennis movie. And the way they did it was kind of ingenious. They hired actual pros to do a recreation of the 1973 match. And I got to speak to the doubles, the tennis doubles. They not only had to go out there and play realistic tennis, they had to go out and play realistic 1973 tennis.
With so wood rackets.
Like wooden rackets with catgut strings. Catgut! Serve and volley, chip and charge, crash the net, all the stuff that you really don't see in the power baseline game anymore. And it took months and months of practicing for them to finally get it down.
I would like to argue that the most convincing actor-athlete of all time is Ed the Monkey in the Ed the Baseball Player.
Oh, game. Yeah. Yes.
A movie followed closely by, of course, John C. Reilly, who looks more like a catcher than anyone I've ever met in my life.
Well, unhappily, I am not familiar with Ed the Monkey. I know that's a terrible thing.
We know
to
what
admit.
You're doing this weekend, Bill.
I do love that Billie Jean King herself has endorsed the tennis playing in this movie, and that's good enough for me. And I hope that we'll all get free tickets in the mail, having endorsed this movie so energetically.
It thrills me, actually, as a huge tennis fan, for people who might not care about the sport or just Emma Stone or Steve Carell fans, to go and actually see this like newly breathing piece of history, because there's never been anything like it for this sport.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Jason Gay of the Wall Street Journal and Will Leach of Sports on Earth. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, guys.
Get out there and see the Ed the Monkey Baseball Player movie.
Two men recently attended an NFL game on a mission they thought might be dangerous. Only a game's Karen Given has our story.
Did you really make him get out of the car before you parked it?
I did. He did not make that up.
Back in August, Pat Dugan got a call from his friend Tim. They've been close since high school, but they don't get to see each other very often. Tim was coming to town on assignment, and he wanted Pat to come with him.
I was a little hesitant at first, but, you know, I thought about it, and I'm like, he needs someone to be looking out for him. But I didn't want anything happening to my car, anything damaged. I said, hey, can you just get out?
I was like, you know what, that's fair enough. I should probably get out of the car right now. You know, I was trying to keep on a brave face because I knew Pat, you know, wasn't super excited about what we were doing.
That's Tim Rohan. He's a staff writer for Sports Illustrated. And his assignment was to attend an NFL game wearing a Colin Kaepernick jersey.
The idea came up a few weeks ago, and I loved it. I loved it immediately. And I said, I want to be the guy that does that.
As you probably know, last fall, Colin Kaepernick sat and later kneeled during the national anthem. He was protesting police brutality and racial injustice. The decision to sit or kneel turned him into the most hated player in the NFL. Except he's not in the NFL anymore. He's a free agent, and despite being more skilled than many quarterbacks currently employed in the league, he's still looking for a job. And Tim had just volunteered to attend an NFL game wearing his jersey. It was up to Tim's bosses to choose which game. Veteran football analyst Peter King called with their decision. He told Tim,
"Okay, you're going to Buffalo week one to do this story." I said, "Are you sure, Buffalo?"
Buffalo fans are notorious. They call themselves the Bills Mafia. Some of them start tailgating on Saturday morning for a Sunday afternoon game. They post lots of videos on YouTube showing their attempts at...
What's the best way to describe it? Daring, inebriated acts. It's like a episode of Jackass, pardon my language.
Last season, Kaepernick got his first start with the 49ers on the road in Buffalo. Vendors outside the stadium sold T-shirts showing him in the crosshairs of a rifle scope. But on September 10th of this season, the Bills were playing the New York Jets, and both teams could potentially use a quarterback like Kaepernick. Tim traveled to Buffalo and stayed with Pat. Tim calls him Dukes. They went out to dinner on Friday night, and when their Uber driver heard what they'd be doing that weekend, she told them to watch out for flying beer cans. And then on Saturday morning, Tim put on his Kaepernick jersey, Pat wore a Bills T-shirt, and the two men drove to New Era Stadium in Pat's car.
By that point, I'd been hanging out with Dukes for 2 days, and I think we were letting our imaginations run wild. You know, I've done some reporting on talking to fans about how they feel about Colin Kaepernick, and this is a very, very hot button issue. It's, you know, race, politics, mix of all these things that are going on in this country right now, symbolized with one person in one jersey. So you know, when Dukes was kind of sitting there nervous, I was, you know, definitely nervous too.
Once Pat got the car safely parked, he and Tim set off to wander the tailgates to see and be seen. There was some shouting. I can't repeat most of it on the radio. But Pat says most people just shook their heads and muttered to themselves. That is, once they recognized what exactly Tim was wearing.
The red color that he was wearing of the jersey, the 49ers jersey, was close enough to some of the alternate jerseys that the Bills wear. And then he'd walk past them or vice versa, and they'd turn and they'd look, and you just see, like, confusion and kind of, like, awe on everyone's face.
That's not a Bills jersey. That's not a Jets jersey. This guy's wearing a Colin Kaepernick jersey.
Did you really get bad looks from a guy in an OJ jersey? I can't remember the last time I saw an OJ jersey.
This is Buffalo, remember? So we saw a lot of OJ Simpson jerseys that day, and I'm sure no one was giving them bad looks.
When Buffalo fans wear an O.J. Simpson jersey, they're not showing their support of a guy who was accused of double murder. They're celebrating the running back who played 9 seasons in Buffalo and was the first NFL player to rush for 2,000 yards in a season.
But there's meaning assigned to Colin Kaepernick's jersey now. I think people, when they wear his jersey in public, they're aligning themselves with him and his politics.
As it turned out, on that Sunday morning, the first people who approached Tim and Pat weren't angry Bills fans. They were two African-American Jets supporters, Lucretia and David, who wanted to take their picture with a guy in a Kaepernick jersey.
You know, it's like if they had seen someone in a Jets jersey, right? They felt like a connection, that we were kind of, you know, maybe on the same side. Yeah, we took a picture together, and then Lucretia gave me a high five and wished me well.
Tim told everyone he talked to that he was on assignment for Sports Illustrated. He wasn't keeping that a secret. And he was planning to use a friend of a friend's tailgate as a sort of home base.
But as soon as we got there, this long-haired, bearded man, he saw the Kaepernick jersey, and he bolted over, and he wanted to talk. He thinks Kaepernick's being blackballed and this and that. just the sight of the Kaepernick jersey really got him going.
Okay, two interactions, three Kaepernick fans. This is not the tally Tim and Pat expected in Buffalo. But they hadn't yet ventured into the parking lot Tim calls the heart of the Bills Mafia. That's where Tim was approached by a guy named Dan. Dan's a veteran and a conservative. He told Tim he sometimes flies a Confederate flag at his tailgate just to get a rise out of people. But like the Kaepernick fans Tim had already met, Dan wasn't angry. He just wanted to talk.
At one point while Dan and I were talking, he pulled out a mason jar and he said, this is some moonshine. He gets a special batch of it from his buddy in Georgia every June. So thought it would have been rude to turn down the moonshine, and it was pretty good.
Before long, Tim and Pat were being introduced around from tailgate to tailgate. That's how they met another veteran named James.
James pulls me and Dukes over to his tailgate, which is across the way. He offered a Jell-O shot, and again, I would have been rude to decline. He had very strong opinions about Kaepernick. At one point, he said, "I spit on the ground that he walks on." And we talked a little bit of politics, and he was telling us about how he served in Afghanistan, and in 2003, he was hit with an RPG. He said that he had shrapnel in the left side of his body and that he had lost his left knee. And we talked for a little bit, and then Dukes and I were off to see what else was going around the tailgate.
Once they got inside the stadium, Tim and Pat stood for the national anthem. They hadn't really considered whether, for the sake of their social experiment, they should do otherwise. And when the anthem was over, an older man approached their seats. Tim was nervous at first, but he didn't need to be.
He smiled and reached out his hand, and he said, "I just want to thank you for standing during the anthem with that jersey on." He said, "We appreciate it." You know, that's not the kind of response that's happening in our political discourse these days, right? So I was kind of taken aback.
It was probably inevitable that Tim and Pat would encounter a fair amount of shouting in Buffalo. But maybe they shouldn't have been so surprised that the people they interacted with just wanted a chance to speak and be heard. Pat says he enjoyed listening to what people had to say, even when he didn't agree with them. But if Tim were to call up next week and ask him to do it again...
I think I'd playfully decline. I already gambled once. I think that was more than enough for me.
That's Pat Dugan speaking with Only a Game's Karen Given. You can find a link to Tim Rowan's Sports Illustrated story, "I Wore a Colin Kaepernick Jersey to an NFL Game," at onlyagame.org. Ever wonder what tennis stars do during rain delays?
I was eating a chocolate bar, looking through a gossip magazine, and I was down and out.
Maria Sharapova tells the story of an especially memorable rain delay just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Meghna Chakrabartyan, and hang on, don't hit that double fast-forward arrow for a second, because I want to tell you about another WBUR podcast I know you're going to love. After all, it's called Modern Love, and it's a collaboration between WBUR and the New York Times, featuring true stories of love, loss, and redemption performed by noteworthy actors.
In any marriage, even the best marriage, there will come a day when you wonder why you married this person.
She's dead to me, I told my friends.
Why did I throw away the best thing I ever had? I wrote in my journal. Please, God, bring her back.
It's easy to love the beautiful, the normal. But what about the gifts of loving the strange, the uncommon, the odd?
Modern Love, the podcast from WBUR and the New York Times. Subscribe right now on your favorite podcast app for a new episode every week.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, if you don't learn baseball until you're 45, how old will you be when you play your first game as a pro? But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. I'm shooting for like 74.
Okay, well, that's an admirable goal, and I hope you make it. On Thursday, we learned that Aaron Hernandez, convicted murderer, late of the New England Patriots, had CTE. He killed himself in prison at the age of 27, and the family has sued the Patriots and the NFL, and they're considering expanding that suit to the University of Florida and the NCAA. Have you any sense of what the impact of all this might be?
Well, I think the first impact is going to be a tsunami of really bad, really hot takes, okay, in various venues. This is going to open a tremendous can of worms because as far as I know, this is the first legal proceeding in which someone will attempt to prove that CTE caused actual murders. Mm. Some of the victims were involved in, you know, domestic assaults and things like that, but this case was so high profile.
The NFL has not been shy about its desire to locate a franchise in London, Charlie. I've been playing games there for some time, and one idea is to give said London team a second facility in the southeast and not southeast London, the southeastern part of the United States. Does this make the whole idea more workable?
No, it makes the whole idea more ludicrous. I actually wrote about the very bizarre circumstances when the Houston Oilers first moved to Tennessee and became the Titans, where they were practicing in Nashville and playing in Memphis. And that was too much of a stress for them. So I'm not sure. I mean, practicing in, you know, Savannah and playing your games in London sounds incredibly bad.
During a game between the Yankees and the Twins on Wednesday afternoon, Charlie, very young fan, was hit in the head with a line drive, thereby strengthening the argument for more protective netting in all the ballparks, as if that argument needed further strengthening. Pretty hard for me to see why anybody would argue against that, isn't it?
There are aesthetic purists who will argue against it, but they're going to lose the argument because liability lawsuits are much more compelling than romantic visions of the old days. And safety is an important thing to think about, too.
The Vegas Golden Knights of the NHL won their first exhibition game 9-4. That was on Sunday. And on Tuesday, they won their second 4-1. That's 13 goals in two games. Vegas loves winners. Have we got a start at creating hockey country there?
I really hope so, because the whole thing is just so freaking hilarious. Once again, I hope we'll hear from our friends at the American Gaming Association in regards to this. But you know, Bill, the interesting thing about that is they win the Stanley Cup. There are so many big, shiny objects in Vegas, you'll never notice it.
Charles Barkley is not happy with the NBA's new schedule, which is designed to provide more time for rest between games. Has he become old enough to be a grumpy old man?
He was a grumpy old man when he was like 15. I mean, that's just Charles being Charles.
I can hear him saying, back in my day, we played against two teams at a time every night.
If Bill Russell wants to make this complaint, who used to play in, you know, the War Memorial Auditorium somewhere two nights after he played in the War Memorial Auditorium in another place, wants to complain about the old days, I'll listen to him. I'm not going to listen to Charles. I'm sorry.
As you know, Charlie, fans of pro soccer teams in England are inclined to make up songs and chants.
And felonies.
And felonies. And they don't make those up. They actually commit them sometimes. Anyway, Manchester United supporters have irked some folks with one chant that they've developed to celebrate a player named Romelu Lukaku. What's the problem?
How do I put this delicately? Nope, you can't do it. They're celebrating Romelu's Romelu, which apparently is of unusual girth, I guess. I don't know. They're trying to determine who put the bump in the bump she bump, yeah, I think, and who put the ram in the ram a lam a ding dong. Yeah, pretty much.
I was pretty sure you'd get to ding dong eventually. Finally, Charlie, four University of Utah students almost got away with sneaking onto the Brigham Young University campus and painting the statue of the Brigham Young Cougar with University of Utah colors. And they would have gotten away with it, except they came back later to take selfies to demonstrate themselves and their work, and they got nabbed. So the moral of this story?
The moral of this story is some parents are wasting a lot of money on a very good education because their kids are stupid.
Yeah, you can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
the tennis circuit is a not-quite-constant grind, almost, though, and after a while the pros fall into a routine that must be at best predictable and sometimes numbing. Except for Wimbledon, where some of the players stay in a village of English cottages.
You had little milk brought to you every morning by your doorstep. It felt like a very different environment to what I was used to at a traditional tournament.
Maria Sharapova first played at Wimbledon in the junior division when she was 15. She'd been preparing for that opportunity for a decade, since 1993, when Martina Navratilova had seen her whacking two-handed backhands with a racket as big as she was in a clinic in Moscow. Navratilova pulled Sharapova's father aside and told him his daughter could compete with the best, but he'd have to get her out of Russia to provide her with that opportunity. He'd have to get her to the U.S. Father and daughter made the leap. They moved to Florida, and it turned out Navratilova was a pretty good judge of talent. In 2004, Sharapova, then 17, made her second appearance in the main draw at Wimbledon, where our story begins off the court. Before the tournament started, you were walking across the lawn to the clubhouse.
Yes.
To put it as delicately as I can, you stepped in the waste of an animal.
I stepped in poop.
Yes.
Right. I didn't realize it. I thought it could have been someone else. And then once I got to the locker room, I knew immediately it was me. And I remember, because at Wimbledon, it's surrounded by these little parks and commons, and I ended up going to the locker room attendant and saying, I think there's something happened to my shoe. I don't have a spare. I need to clean this up. Is there anyone that can help me with this? You know, I felt kind of embarrassed going to the sink in front of all the players and taking my shoe off. And a handyman outside the locker room actually helped me clean my shoe. And then later told me that it was good luck.
Good luck, because it was foxcat, and stepping in that stuff is good luck, right? I mean, everybody knows that.
I did not believe him. I thought he was being very nice, but I didn't think much of it.
Well, maybe she began thinking something of it once the tournament began. Sharapova lost only 3 games in her first round match, only 4 in the second round, and just 4 more in the third. Amy Frazier, a veteran who'd been ranked as high as 13 in the world, tested Sharapova in the fourth round, but the 17-year-old won 6-4, 7-5, so the luck of the sloppy shoe held up then. And in the quarterfinals as well, where Sharapova outlasted Ai Sugiyama 7-5, 5-7, 6-1. Sharapova says the run to the semifinals wasn't as easy as it might have looked.
It was intimidating in many ways, and my opponents were intimidating, but I like that feeling. I love being in the spotlight. Mm. That was what I had trained for.
That training, remember, had begun when Sharapova was 6. It had necessitated that move to Florida, where her father had heard there were some tennis academies. But now she'd be in the spotlight, illuminating the semifinals of the world's most prestigious tennis tournament.
I remember sitting down with my coach after my quarterfinal match and being in the player restaurant, and my coach, you know, noticed that the feeling around me had changed and that people were noticing who I was and how I was playing tennis and were coming up to me and asking me for pictures and autographs. And he said, you know what, from now on, I want you in the next rounds, I want you to treat this as, just want you to put on these horse blinders and I want you to have this vision and focus, like you're just looking straight ahead and nowhere else. And I remember that very vividly because it was like immediately I put on those horse blinders.
Good idea, I guess, except when she looked straight ahead, the only direction she could look with those metaphorical blinders on, Sharapova saw a bigger, better, stronger, more experienced version of herself. Lindsay Davenport, her semifinal opponent, favored the same hard, low shot Sharapova had been working to master. But Davenport had won 3 Grand Slam singles titles, including Wimbledon, as well as an Olympic gold medal, all of which her 17-year-old opponent understood.
I mean, at that point, I still felt very much like a kid. I wasn't physically strong yet. I didn't have the experience. She did everything much better than I did. Everything and more. And there was no reason for me to win that match.
Well, maybe one reason, or one besides the fox gunk, rain. But I'm getting ahead of myself. When the semifinal match began, it went pretty much as Maria Sharapova had assumed it would.
I felt from the beginning she was overpowering me. Like, everything that I did, she was able to return and do better. And it wasn't even about mistakes or any other things. She just did it better. She hit it harder. Her serve had more power, had more accuracy. She found the lines, and I didn't. And she wasn't making errors, and I was. And so, I mean, that's just a horrible combination.
When the rain first delayed that horrible combination of events, Sharapova felt the situation was hopeless. She was probably wishing the skies wouldn't clear, but they did, and she and Davenport returned to the court. The plot remained unchanged. Davenport won the first set, 6-2, and continued to power her way toward the final. And then it rained some more.
I went back to the locker room during that delay. I was eating a chocolate bar. I was getting a little rub down on my legs in the massage room and looking through a gossip magazine and, you know, with the idea that I'd be flying back to the States the next day. I was down and out.
And your dad had something to say at the break, right?
He did. So as I was going back on the court, he looks at me straight in the eyes and says, "You're going to win this match." And I looked at him and I laughed, and then I realized he was serious. And then I became scared of what he was saying. But he gave me this confidence and idea that I could actually win it.
Yuri Sharapov had possessed that confidence almost since his daughter had first picked up a tennis racket. That has to have been the case, right? He'd taken her out of Russia and begged the tennis camps in Florida to make room for her. He'd pushed through back spasms and worked construction to pay their rent. He'd pinned his future and the fortunes of his family on Maria's tennis game. So as he waited for his daughter's match against Lindsay Davenport to begin again, he told her that he'd had a dream in which she'd won the Wimbledon title. And then, perhaps preposterously, he told her that she had Davenport right where she wanted her because it had been too easy for the former champ. Davenport would already have been thinking about the tournament final rather than about how to finish off the Russian kid. And he was right. His daughter turned the match around in the second set, beating Davenport 7-6. The final set was anticlimactic. Sharapova won it 6-1. Now, all she had to do was face the world's best female player. Serena Williams had won the previous two Wimbledon singles titles. Why shouldn't she make it three? Sharapova has an answer.
Look, I was going into that final as someone that had absolutely nothing to lose. And she, on the other hand, was a two-time defending champion, so completely different stories. And I felt like she was the one that had a lot to lose. Like, there was a lot on the line for her.
Since that day at Wimbledon, Serena Williams has owned Maria Sharapova. Sharapova can't deny it. She's said it over and over.
I mean, she's owned me for the rest of my career, pretty much.
Like I said, she's lost to Williams 18 times and beaten her just once since that day. But on that day...
What a story! What a star! What a champion!
It was Sharapova, 6-1, 6-4. Her father had been prescient, or maybe he'd made up the dream. Doesn't matter. She was the champ.
Now you've got the hands on that beautiful trophy, do you believe it?
No. Oh, my God. It's unreal. It's unreal. But
did winning Wimbledon that year change everything? Did it shape your career as you were going forward? I mean, was that something you were aware of as it was happening?
It brought a lot of amazing things, and it felt like overnight. You know, it definitely felt like, wow, out of nowhere, this comes. And maybe I expected myself to win later in my career. But when you think of everything that you go through, I definitely believe that I belong. Maybe not physically, not experience-wise, but tennis-wise, mentality-wise. Like, I was there to win it. And as I look back, that feeling hasn't changed.
Maria Sharapova is 31 now. She's made tens of millions of dollars on endorsements, though she's also said that success hasn't been entirely glorious, that becoming a champion can lead to feelings of entitlement, even that, quote, in short, winning bleeps you up. She recently finished serving a suspension for using a medication called meldonium. She says she failed to notice that it had been added to the list of banned substances last year. She returned to the circuit at the U.S. Open late last month. She beat the number two player in the world and made it to the quarterfinals. Though she has acknowledged that she has begun to imagine her retirement, she's also said she'd like to win another Grand Slam title. It would be her sixth. Meanwhile, she's got a book out, Unstoppable. I wonder how Serena Williams feels about that title. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Brian Bouchard. Our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from Maria Sharapova, or, as my dear friend Bud Collins used to say, Sharapova.
So that's the Russian way to pronounce my name. Sharapova works. Whatever's easier for you.
Gosh, a five-time Grand Slam winner and gracious, too. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks very much for listening.